Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
Last night, I was cooking up some chicken thighs for dinner, just putting on some salt and pepper, olive oil, obviously, lemon juice. And I started thinking about an email I got from my cousin about dinner options for our upcoming family reunion. And it cracked me up how many choices there were: vegetarian, vegan, pescatarian, or, quote, regular, which I'm sure means something like pork or beef. And the reason it made me laugh was because I was imagining my grandmother's face if she were alive to hear about all of this. My stern German grandmother, who experienced serious food shortages and hunger during and after World War II. For her, dinner was whatever was on your plate. But today, a lot of us think harder about what we eat and whether we should eat meat. It's a luxury to be able to do so, of course. I mean, I'm glad to have delicious chicken in my pan, but check out these numbers for a moment. Americans eat a ton of meat, over 200 pounds of it per person per year. Consumption is on the rise. It might even hit record levels next year. There are serious implications in our diet choices. Eating too much meat can impact your health. Meat production takes a lot of resources. It has a big effect on the environment. And of course, there are ethical concerns to ponder. How were those animals treated? On today's show, we're going to take a closer look at the meat we eat. Our first story explores a potential revolution in how meat is made. It would eliminate the need to kill animals. Elizabeth Fiedler reports on this new frontier, but her trek started in a traditional place.
Think about how we produce meat and milk. There's the farmer, the animals, and dirt. Rebecca Ruth Seidel looks perfectly in her element in a navy blue coverall and boots. She's standing in a grassy pasture surrounded by a bunch of brown and white speckled cows. And they're keeping their gaze on her while she tears apart an orange and offers them pieces.
There you go. You just keep dropping it.
Rebecca's a cheesemaker at Wholesome Dairy Farms in Berks County, Pennsylvania. Farm life is dirty, smelly, hard work. She's a fourth-generation dairy farmer, so she's used to this, and she's also unfazed by a torrent of cow pee.
My great-grandfather had cows. My grandfather had cows. My father had cows. It's our life. It's our way of life.
This is all Rebecca has known, but she's open to some scientific advancements that might completely change how we think about dairy and meat production.
We don't want to have to slaughter an animal.
That's Eric Schultze. He's a senior scientist at Memphis Meats. The company produces meat by tracking down some high-quality animals that already exist. And then
we do a harmless biopsy and bring those cells back to our production facility, and we grow them. We're making living cells turn into muscle tissue that we then can eat, which is what meat is, muscles.
The company has produced chicken and duck this way. It looks just like what we're used to, but they call it clean meat. The process requires just a tiny fraction of the land and water that's currently used to raise and slaughter cows, chickens, and pigs each year. And the process starts with cells.
We can grow them in these large vats, if you will, like you would find at a brewery. We feed them sugars, fats, vitamins, minerals, the same things that you need to grow. These cells then can use that energy to produce and turn themselves into muscle, and then that can be processed into this, you know, similar cuts of meat and products that you buy at the grocery store right now.
But how would this go over with traditional meat consumers? Would it feel too unnatural or science fiction-y? I asked my friend Marilyn D'Angelo. She's a foodie, and her grandfather was a butcher.
I like pork roll and scrapple. I mean, a good roast with the good fat, and it cooks all night. What else? A nice pork loin. You do a little rub.
Would you eat meat that's grown in a lab?
I guess it depends on how it's prepared. Maybe. It's bizarre. It's a whole new, I don't know. I guess it's a little weird, but I would probably still eat it.
I was kind of surprised. I'm a vegetarian, and I might be willing to try it, but I can see it being a really tough sell for a lot of people. These clean meats aren't available yet, and it seems like many people haven't thought much about them, other than that it's kind of weird. So I asked Lars Perner. He's a marketing professor at the University of Southern California.
This is not just an area where people would think rationally. A lot of people at an emotional level may still not feel comfortable, and it may take a while with the perceptions people may have that this is somehow not real food, that this is sort of a Frankensteinian kind of concoction.
Still, Lars says he would eat it. He thinks many consumers probably have an idealized image of traditional farming, with happy animals frolicking in a pasture. That's the image we're sold, but that's not what most farming looks like.
In these modern kind of factory farms, you often see very artificial conditions. You also have a lot of cattle being raised on feedlots, and in the United States, many cattle are fed corn, which is really not a natural food for cows. And there have been all sorts of enhancements done over time to make meat production more efficient, to get greater yields. So it's already highly artificial.
So jumping from there to a petri dish may not be that big of a leap. And the people making meat in labs say it could actually be healthier than the traditional kind because it can be produced in a sterile environment free of antibiotics and growth hormones. Eric Schultze from Memphis Meats says the chicken they make tastes just like meat you'd buy in a store because it's fundamentally the same thing. The products aren't on the market yet. Part of the challenge is bringing the price down. Right now, it costs about $6,000 a pound to produce, but that number has been dropping drastically over the last few years. Eric says farming from animal cells has an advantage.
In conventional farming, you have to grow everything else that's attached to the muscle, the cow itself, right? The bones, the brains, and it has to maintain that and grow and grow and grow until it's slaughtered. We have to produce muscle. That's it. Our cells only do one thing, and they do it well. Produce meat. And we can optimize the environment in which they grow. The cells themselves can be optimized to produce meat more efficiently.
If people buy into this new way of producing meat, it could have a big environmental impact. But it doesn't necessarily mean eliminating conventional farming. Here's Rebecca Ruth Seidel, our dairy farmer, surrounded by her living, breathing cows.
I see cellular agriculture both as a way of increasing the availability of food in a growing population, and also making traditionally raised products, traditionally raised animal proteins, a niche market. Right now, we've seen the effects that the organic label, the grass-fed label, have had on the food market, where you can specialize and request and get a higher price point. I think this is just an additional level of specialization.
She knows there's strong resistance from some in the farming community. As companies continue to push science to create not just meat, but also milk and eggs. Rebecca's family has been in this business for generations, and change is always part of the process.
The way we're consuming animal proteins right now, I look at skim milk, I look at industrially processed yogurts, I look at egg patties, chicken breasts, hamburgers. All of those are constituent parts of animals that don't necessarily need to come off a living animal.
And get this. Winston Churchill said the exact same thing decades ago, anticipating that we would one day escape the absurdity of growing a whole chicken in order to eat the breast or wing.
That was Elizabeth Fiedler reporting, and I'll try that lab-grown meat when the price is down to, what, $3,000 a pound? Just kidding. We're talking about meat on the show today, and right now we're looking at how meat is produced and what role science plays in that process. Alan Yu is here now. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Maiken.
You wanted us to go to a really cool restaurant for our next story. It's in Philadelphia. It's called Kensington Quarters.
Right. They have a charcuterie plate on their menu that I wanted us to try for research, of course, and they make all their products in-house.
So we went, we ordered.
I think we're just going to get the mixed charcuterie plate and we'll share it.
Would you like to do the small or the large?
Let's do the large.
Large, excellent.
And we also got to meet the butcher. His name is Jake Wilson.
Yeah, I like how passionate Jake was about his work and the flavors in it.
When you like first bite into like a cured meat like that you've never had before, and like you get like the saltiness, the sweet from the curing process, and like the different spices blended so well, there's nothing like it anywhere else.
So like a proud dad, he described everything that was on that plate for us.
So starting on the left side, we have our smoked pastrami. Going into the center, we have a nice pork liver pate. Directly below that, we have a smoked aged speck.
Let's start with the speck that looks like bacon with not so much fat, right? And very thinly sliced. How does that look when you first start working on it?
Well, we take a whole picnic ham, which is the lower end of a pork shoulder. And we debone it, remove the skin, and cure it for 10 days.
And that is raw meat that Jake starts out with. And I had to keep reminding myself, like, wow, none of this stuff is really cooked in the traditional sense.
Right, so it's cooked through the process of salting. And that's what got me interested in cured meat. You have to get the process right to make sure there are no harmful bacteria. And science is coming up with some new ways of making sure the meat is safe. Because it's not just professional butchers like Jake curing their own meat. People are doing this at home now.
People are talking about how they're capturing the bounty of their materials and changing it in-house and developing flavor. And as a scientist, I'm much more interested in how did they ensure that the inherent risks have been managed?
That's Ted Russin, a scientist at the Culinary Institute of America. He says people need to know it's tricky to make sure this meat is safe. Think about how a sausage is made.
We grind the meat. So we're essentially pushing the surface of the meat into the center of the sausage. So now you can look at this and say, well, the whole thing has a bacterial population distributed throughout.
Usually when we eat meat, you have what's called a kill step. That's typically heat that kills harmful bacteria. One way to do that is to sear meat in a pan. But with most charcuterie meats, like salami or prosciutto, there is no heat. They're cold smoked or cured or dried.
In a fermented meat sausage, we don't cook a fermented meat sausage. We don't do that. That would be a very odd sausage.
So instead, you can make the sausage acidic or remove the water so bacteria can't grow. If there's a heaven for meat lovers, it might look something like this. I'm in a white room with a tall ceiling and row after row of sausages and salami and ham. This is the New England Charcuterie in Boston. I'm there with Ji Jiang, the facilities manager.
You have a whip of that like nice salami taste, that like sweetness of like the meat, and I can kind of smell a hint of smokiness because we're currently drying a boneless leg of ham. Rub it juniper and like herbs.
Some of these meats will hang there for 2 years before they're done. Joshua Smith is the owner. He says it's almost impossible to keep all harmful bacteria out, so it's just a matter of testing and coming up with a plan to handle them. Every time we walk through a door at his factory, we hear this.
It's a sanitizer solution that sprays a highly concentrated sanitizer on the floor that I will ask that you walk through and wipe your feet in.
One of the big worries is listeria, which can be a serious issue in cured meat. It can cause a fever and diarrhea. In some cases, it can be deadly. It's why the CDC says pregnant women should not eat uncooked deli meat. Joshua gets his meat tested regularly. He used to send samples to a lab for routine testing, and he'd have to wait 2 days before he knew for sure that the meat from that batch was free of harmful bacteria.
At any given time, we could be talking about $500,000 in product that basically it's halted until we identify that everything is safe.
But now Joshua is using a quicker test from a food safety company called Sample 6. The test from Sample 6 only takes 6 hours, which means Joshua's $500,000 of product is only held up for 6 hours, rather than 2 days. The test works by using an engineered virus that targets only listeria. Sample 6 co-founder Michael Kors explains the virus will inject a bit of DNA into any living listeria cells, and the DNA makes listeria produce a specific enzyme.
It's related to the firefly tail glow enzyme. So as we all see fireflies with their glowing tails and such, so will this microscopic bacterium turn itself into a mini firefly.
Meaning that if there's harmful bacteria, the sample will glow in a detection machine. Back at New England Charcuterie, facility manager Ji Zhang is swabbing random spaces for bacteria. He does this once a month. He swabs a coworker's gloves, knives, the meat containers, and the wheels on their carts. Then he puts the samples in an incubator. If they're glowing after 6 hours, that means there's listeria. This is also how Ben & Jerry's and Breyer's ice cream is tested. But there are some people who are grumbling about applying all this modern testing to an old art form. Chef J.J. Lewitt at the Culinary Institute of America says, okay, I get it, but this is the new reality. He told me a story about Italian cheese making. People traditionally used wooden cheese molds and wicker baskets. He recently took his students to visit a cheesemaker in the south of Italy.
The cheesemaker was using white polythene cheese molds. And our students said to him, where's the wooden molds for making cheese? And the Italian cheesemaker, through a translator, said, well, we can't use those anymore. It's against the law. We have to use this white plastic.
The white plastic can be sterilized. Chef J.J. Lewis says Italian salami makers, just like the cheesemakers, are highly regulated.
Is it taking away the old-fashioned sort of approach? Yes, but times change.
The testing doesn't mean the sausage tastes any different. Joshua Smith from New England Charcuterie was in fact inspired by the idea of bringing science and tradition together.
The pursuit of creating the old world, you know, ways in a technologically advanced setting was really interesting to me, and that was what I proceeded to pursue.
That was Alan Yu reporting. We eat a lot of pork. I mean, you quote the number 32.2 pounds for every person on Earth in a year? Mm. That is a lot of pig.
Yes. Especially when you consider that more than half of the population doesn't actually consume pork for religious reasons.
Wow.
Yes, so it's a lot.
I might be eating 60 pounds of pig a year. I'll start counting that. I was confessing my potentially above average pork consumption to Pia Spry Marquez. She has a new book. It's called Pig Pork: Archaeology, Zoology, and Edibility. And it explores how important pigs have been to humans throughout history. They've been domesticated for 8,000 years. And in that long time span, people have often used pigs and eating pork as a way of saying, there's us and there's them. I asked Pia about a chapter in her book where she talks about pork consumption in 15th century Spain.
So this was a time in Spain where we had three completely different religions living in harmony. So we had the Jewish population, the Muslim, and the Catholics. But it was Isabella and Ferdinand, the Catholic monarchs of the 15th century, who decided that they wanted everyone to be Catholic. And the easiest way of separating those who were true converts was by using what was common to the other two religions, which was pork. And that's why pork, in a way, features so prominently in Spanish cuisine, because it was a way of really seeing who had become a Catholic. So a lot of, for example, Jewish dishes, they incorporated pork into them as a way of, you know, making them more Catholic. So one of the typical stews that we have in Spain, the Madrid stew, it comes from a Jewish recipe called adafina, which you had on the Sabbath.
The pig has sometimes a reputation for being a dirty animal. Obviously, we call people swine who are dirty or have disgusting behaviors. And it has also been tied to different diseases that have plagued mankind. Is there any truth to that, or has the pig gotten a bad rep?
In a way, I think they've got a bad rep. So they're not dirty animals. So this idea, for example, that pigs, you know, they roll in the mud and that makes them dirty. As a matter of fact, they do that because they are incapable of sweating. So this expression that we have, sweating like a pig, is actually not true because they cannot sweat. Having said that, of course, you can get diseases from the consumption of infested animals, but so can you from other creatures.
Your attitude toward eating pork, changed over the course of writing this book. So talk a little bit about how your understanding evolved and where you are now.
Well, I started this book being a full omnivore. And before I started writing this book, I didn't realize all the many strands in which we have pork and pigs in our daily lives. And that just got me thinking about how little we know as consumers. Having found out all the intelligence of pigs and all the different ways in which they've helped us, it just didn't feel right to continue consuming their bodies just for a few minutes of my own gastronomic satisfaction. It didn't make sense when there were perfectly good alternatives that didn't require anyone's suffering. So that's when I decided that I would become vegan, and I've been vegan since.
P.S. Bri Marquez has a new book. It's called Pig Pork: Archaeology, Zoology, and Edibility. And I think a lot of us can relate to what she just said. When you really start thinking about meat and the animals, then you start feeling a certain discomfort. Every time I'm in the grocery store and I'm looking at all the packages of chicken and beef and pork, I'm reminded of a story that a famous chef told me years ago. His name is Thomas Keller from the French Laundry. This is a very expensive Michelin star restaurant in California. And he said at one point in his career, he realized that he was ordering meat like a mob boss orders a hit. He'd make a phone call and pay his money, and then poof, everything got delivered to his kitchen, neatly trimmed and packaged. No blood on his hands. So one day he decided that he should really know how to butcher an animal. He tried rabbits first, but once he was face to face with a twitchy bunny nose, he couldn't do it. He almost had a nervous breakdown. And this story has stuck with me for a long time because I think a lot of us have trouble thinking about consuming meat. We don't want animals to suffer. I could never kill a pig. I know that, but I can eat a pork roast. So where do we go with that? A lot of meat eaters ease their conscience by purchasing meat that is humanely raised and slaughtered. But what exactly does that look like? Let's take a trip to Double Brook Farm in New Jersey. They raise sheep, pigs, turkeys, and chickens from the moment they are born to the moment of slaughter. Owner John McConaughey takes us inside what he hopes is a kinder kill.
So we are at the slaughterhouse, and so we'll get out and walk around, but as you can see, it's in the middle of the farm. The pigs are born here. The sheep come over here once they're weaned from their mothers. The chickens are over here, and so they're within sight, often within the same complex as the slaughterhouse. They see it their entire lives. It's part of their experience. It's part of what they know, and so when it comes time for them to be harvested, we walk them to the slaughterhouse. So they never get on a trailer. They never have to experience the stress that goes along with most slaughterhouses. They don't have to experience the stress with being with animals that they don't know. Stress hormones affect the acid levels, which affect the meat to the point, in some cases, where it's inedible. So here, they walk to the slaughterhouse. They know the farmers because the farmers are part of the slaughter process, and it's something they're very comfortable with. So this is where the pigs that go to slaughter spend their days. This gate gets connected, and so the pigs will walk down this alleyway that brings them into the holding pens. This is where you can see their personalities, especially that we just happen to be here when the last one is waiting its turn to go in. That if we got here in the beginning and they're all together, that, you know, there's comfort in a group, and so it's a smart animal. And he was here with 9 of its other litter mates. You know, as they went one by one, I think that there's probably some consideration that he's curious why he's the last one remaining. The holding pen area then opens into what they call the knock box, which is the area that the animal is confined and constrained until it's knocked, which is the process of rendering it unconscious, either with electric shock, which is quick and painless, or with a captive bolt, which is almost like a bullet that goes into its head, which again is quick and painless. if we were to leave the animals after that, eventually they would die. But the actual cause of death is the arteries are cut and the blood is emptied from their body. And the reason it's done that way is because that's the blood. If the blood were not emptied from the body, it would greatly affect the meat. So that's the way it's been done for thousands of years. So this is the kill floor. Here comes one of the butchers who's about to bring in another pig. So this is part of the process. So in a commercial slaughterhouse, there is a pig every 15 to 20 seconds, right? And so 15 to 20 seconds, we're watching the process now, and we've probably been standing here for a minute and a half watching this whole thing go on. You can see the pig is not too upset by the whole thing.
It's in there.
So its brain was killed with a bullet going into its brain, which started the nervous system operating so that the animal started to kick and convulse. The butchers then cut the jugular vein so that the blood started to flow, and the heart will start to beat, continue to beat for another 3, 4, 5 minutes after the brain has been killed. They put it onto a cradle where they then start to work on taking the toenails off. They also cut the breastplate so that they, once they start to eviscerate, they can get into the chest cavity. And then they remove the head. It's then hoisted back up again. It moves down the line. They make an incision to take out the insides. I happen to think that the slaughter process is something that most people should watch if they're going to eat animals. And if it turns them away from animals, then that's probably a good thing. But at the very least, it gives you an understanding that it was a living animal, and that if you're going to order it at a restaurant, that you don't necessarily want the 24-ounce steak that you're not going to be able to finish. Maybe you want the 8-ounce steak that reduces the number of animals that need to be killed to feed us, and B, means that it's not going to go into the garbage. So one of the big differences with our kids versus other kids is that they very rarely waste anything, because they understand that these animals gave their lives for us.
John McConaughey at Double Brook Farm in New Jersey. Paige Schlager produced this story, and what she saw there has changed how she thinks about food, too.
Well, after all that, I'm probably never going to eat pork again.
How about you? What are you thinking about in terms of food choices these days? Get in on the conversation. You can find us on Facebook, WHYY The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. CTCA offers genomic testing to help doctors determine treatment options based on patients' personal genetic makeup. Genomic tumor assessment may hold the key to help patients improve quality of life and discover more precise treatment options that were previously not considered. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
Have you ever had sweat pouring down your face after eating a big steak or maybe a couple of hamburgers? Some people swear that's a thing.
This is Chris from South Philly, and I'm here to tell you that the meat sweats are absolutely real.
Chris says he gets them when he overindulges at a family picnic or in a restaurant.
It's that time when you realize that you're sweating and your skin is flush and you are sort of delirious, not really sure what day or time it is. Yeah, that's the meat sweats.
Connor Corcoran in Los Angeles also gets meat sweats. He told me he went to his favorite restaurant on Santa Monica Boulevard last night.
I didn't order the steak. I couldn't order the steak. I knew what would happen if I ordered the steak.
Instead, he got the veal,
which was just this thinly pounded, breaded piece of veal that came with a lemon slice. It's so pretty and thin, they call it the veal George Clooney. but I still got the sweats.
I believe you, Connor, but are meat sweats really real?
So meat sweats are not technically an actual thing, or at least science hasn't said that they're an actual thing.
That's Brittany Kennedy. She's a nutritionist. Her company is called On Point Nutrition. And she says the digestion process holds some clues into meat sweats. So let's say you've just eaten a 15-ounce steak.
Once you eat that steak, digestion starts in your mouth, actually. So, you know, as you're chewing the steak and the saliva is breaking it all down, then it ends up coming to your stomach. So protein itself is very tightly bound. You know, protein's made up of a ton of amino acids that are linked together kind of like a chain, or almost like a chain link fence. And your body has to work really hard to break those apart. You could be breaking that down for 6 to 8 hours.
Brittany says when you're digesting food, more blood flow goes towards your stomach, and actually your body temperature does go up slightly.
And that's where that like thermogenic effect comes into play, because your body uses, you know, I'd say 30% of the energy that you're eating from meat to actually break it down. So that increased blood flow causes your metabolism to start increasing. It's breaking down all of that protein, which then could in turn increase your internal temperature, which may cause you to sweat.
But for that to happen, you would have to eat a ton of meat, like 6 big chicken breasts or a whole roast. So let's ask somebody who actually does eat that much meat.
I'm Bob Schout. I go by Notorious B.O.B. I'm a 50-year-old competitive eater out of Royers Ford, Pennsylvania.
Bob's specialties include volume food like grits or baked beans.
2.4 gallons of chowder in 6 minutes to win the slammin' jammin'.
But he also eats plenty of meat. He just got back from an eating contest that involved a 55-ounce hamburger.
It's maybe 6 or 7 really large beef patties on the burger. Each patty is bigger than a way bigger than a normal burger.
Bob is the reigning champ of the Wing Bowl. That's an eating competition held in Philadelphia each year just before the Super Bowl. And to win, he had to eat 409 wings. So did he ever get the meat sweats?
If you're in a hot dog contest, you tend to start sweating. But I don't think it really has anything to do with the meat. I think it just has to do with you're out in the sun. And when you're in a contest, you have adrenaline going. So you're pumped up and you're pushing your body to the limit. So it could be, you know, 5 pounds of asparagus you're eating, and you're still going to break out in a sweat in the summertime in a contest.
So I guess the meat sweats are not a thing, and perhaps a good rule of thumb is this.
If you're sweating after eating a steak, there's probably something wrong.
Steak was too big?
Steak was way too big.
And about that big steak, beef is a major part of the American diet, and it's a huge part of our economy. It's the largest single sector of American agriculture. In states like Texas, Nebraska, or Kansas, raising cattle is a way of life. The wide open landscape, cattle ranches, horses, and of course, cowboys. And Russia, not usually known to want to imitate the American way of life, wants in on all of this. Russia has experienced a lot of hunger in its history. And in 2010, the country signed something called the Doctrine of Food Security. It's a document that basically says Russia should aim to be self-sufficient in feeding its people. And the plan includes beef. They've been trying to create a gigantic beef industry from scratch. They have enough space to do this. They brought in prime cattle from America for breeding. But they've encountered challenges in surprising places. One of them, the lack of cowboys. Irina Zhurov takes us to a rodeo in Russia to see how the beef industry there is faring.
I'm on a farm in Bryansk, about 300 miles southwest of Moscow. Everything on this farm looks brand new, because it is. The farm is just a year old, and the tractors, the administrative buildings, the gravel work roads, the fencing, somehow even the cows themselves sparkle. As far as rodeos go, everything here is similar to an American rodeo, except a little different. The cowboys enter the arena to patriotic songs, just like in the U.S. But here, one song is about how America should return Alaska to Russia. Another is about Russia's untapped mightiness. Give me a horse and a sword. No swords here, but plenty of horses and tons of people who've come to watch. They've brought signs and they cheer for their teams as they struggle to rope steers in the arena. Watching the proceedings is Sean Weeks. He says in the U.S., rodeo started as friendly competition between ranches.
Well, my cowboys are better than your cowboys. My horses are better than your horses. And so it kind of was the same idea here.
Except here, one company owns all the competing farms, Muratorg. Weeks is one of a handful of American contractors currently working on Muratorg farms. He's like the most cowboy I've ever met.
I'm actually a fourth-generation cowboy. That's my family history.
As we talk, his horse chews hay nearby, and he throws a rope around a dummy bull, casually practicing his lasso skills.
I grew up doing this, you know. A rope was actually my first toy.
Before he reached his teen years, he was putting in hours as a ranch hand. He's got a great big mustache and wears Western boots, a hat, and a tucked-in button-up shirt. When Muratorg hired him 2 years ago, he carried on his saddle, made by his dad, on the flight over. Muratorg started acquiring land in 2010, most of it fallow fields abandoned when the Soviet Union fell apart. Shortly after, Muratorg started populating that land with thousands of cows, flown or shipped in from places like the U.S. In the U.S., it took more than 100 years of breeding to make animals specifically for beef. Russia has only had dairy cows, which don't make good meat. By bringing in fine-tuned genetics, the Russians skipped a huge step in building up a herd.
I've never seen anything grow this fast, ever. And sometimes it kind of sets me back a little bit, like, whoa, let's slow this train down a little bit. But this is their, you know, this is their program and this is what they want, so I just try to help them the best I can.
By copying the structure of Western beef operations, Muratorg is single-handedly trying to create an American-style beef industry, but in a very condensed time period. It now has about 400,000 cows, the largest herd in the world. The company has had to build fences in a country without any, to train veterinarians, and to also import everything from horses and grass seed to tractors. But the hardest part of managing this immense operation is not the science or the planning. It's finding workers. Cowboys. And that's where Weeks comes in. His job is teaching locals to cowboy. The new hires, mostly young men from nearby villages, have no experience. Most of them have only seen cowboys in black and white movies.
The difference is they're starting out from scratch. There's only a handful of us here to try to teach all these people how to do this.
Muratorg now employs 1,000 Russian cowboys. They call them operators, though. Yep, operators. They've managed to make cowboys sound bureaucratic. Weeks says it's been hard translating cowboy work ethic and skills to the operators. For example, last summer, he got a call asking him to come help out in a herding emergency.
And they said, we need you to come and move these steers because we tried to move them and it was a bad deal.
So he gets there and starts rounding up the 600 steers, and everything seems to be going just fine.
And I thought, man, I just don't see what the problem is, other than maybe they got going a little fast yesterday. And
then he approaches the gate, and the animals become nervous.
All of a sudden, I hear this chi-ching, chi-ching, and I, what in the world? And I turn around trying to find this sound. Here comes two guys riding over the hill behind us on bicycles with the little handlebar bells on them. They thought they were going to help us move these steers with these bicycles.
These particular operators wouldn't ride horses, so they tried using bikes to herd the cows.
You know, I hate to admit it, but if they learned how to do things right, they could do it. But I'm not going to tell them that. I want cowboys.
If you're going to replicate the beef system, you might as well get all the parts right, he says. And what's a proper cowboy that can't show off at a rodeo? The announcer reviews scores for the teams, and Weeks looks out at his operators, steely-eyed.
They can do better than that, and they know it, and I know it too.
I go wander the grounds. I find steak cooking demonstrations, information on how the farm works, cows to pet. It's like one big advertisement for beef. In the U.S., a steak starts with a calf that spends about a year on pasture, proceeds to a feedlot, then a processing facility, then a store or restaurant. Each step is its own industry with myriad players. Because none of that has existed in Russia, Miratorg encompasses all of those sectors under one giant roof and has had to build them up along with the ranches. Hence the cooking demos. They kind of have to train steak eaters, too. Back in the arena, a team called Mlin rides out to a relatively toned-down folk song. People in the stands chant to encourage them. It takes an operator named Yevgeny Landik several tries, but he finally ropes the steer. He looked nervous angling up to the calf, but afterwards, he says he wasn't.
The American taught us that we have to take it just like a work. So that's what I did. I just went out as if to work and did my job and left. That's all. Nothing to worry about. You just have to show them how you work in the field.
He's one of Miratorg's up-and-coming operators, young, quiet, serious. He's wearing a floral silk kerchief around his neck. The company gave the operators kerchiefs with traditional Russian designs on them for the rodeo. They're a Russian take on the silk bandanas American cowboys wear, just like the operators or the Russians take on cowboys.
Russian cowboys impatient. They got uncontrollable passion. Once a Russian cowboy gets impatient, there is nothing to stop him. That's how we are. The Russians are like, hurry, hurry, faster. I'll get him first. Come on, come on.
Landik gets back on his horse for the next event. I know he's not talking about Miratorg's business plan, but I can't help but draw a parallel as he talks. Hurry, hurry, faster, faster. In a kind of throwback to the Soviets' penchant for ambitious plans, Miratorg's proposal calls for doubling the number of their farms and cows. It's a big investment, and they haven't turned a profit yet. They started selling meat 2 years ago, but beef doesn't sell that well, at least in part because it's so expensive in Russia. Perhaps measuring success instead starts with a man named Sergei Shilin. He's the company's most convincing operator.
I try to approximate the American cowboy.
Shilin has on a hat given to him by an American when he caught his first steer by the hind legs. Another American gifted him the boots he's wearing for working well together. He's from a nearby village and used to work at a dairy operation, which fell apart. He says he thought he knew cows, but his first day at Miratorg as an operator was difficult.
Right away, they give me a horse. It was an American horse. I couldn't control the same way as the Russian horses. Not knowing how to work with them, I got two bulls stressed out, and we needed to transfer them section to section. The bulls came at me. It was hard.
His wife made him go back the next day, and he progressed quickly from there. After 2 years as an operator, he took a job as a trainer. Now he teaches riding and roping skills at a recently opened cowboy academy. Sounds official, right? A whole academy to train operators because they're hiring so many, so fast, and it's all just so, so new. Shilin, of course, loves it.
For me, this is becoming a lifestyle. At the current time, this cowboy work is real lifestyle. I cherish it, God willing them. My son grows up and I want him to be a Russian cowboy too. He's 4 months old right now. In the near future, I want him to be a cowboy as well.
The rodeo is winding down. In the arena, the participants receive their prizes, about $100 to buy Western wear. That might be a little hard because there's nowhere locally to buy it. And then, there's one more surprise.
There's parachutists coming down.
Parachutists, who the DJs call aerial cowboys, float down into the arena with Russian flags and Muratorg flags. The foreigners are in awe.
That was a little bit close.
That was a little close.
All this for some steaks. But of course, the steaks are so much more than that. A symbol of success, of Russia's ability to take care of its own. So how are the steaks anyway? Shilin says he doesn't know.
To tell you the truth, I haven't ever tried the steak yet. I have never tried the meat.
Why not, I ask?
To tell you the truth, I just haven't had a chance. And especially the marble steaks. For me, for now, it's too expensive. And I can't afford to buy a kilo of this meat. I think in the future, I will try it with my family.
So, for now, a Russian cowboy is also one who doesn't eat steak.
That was Irina Zhorov reporting. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Megan Pinto is our executive producer, Paige Flager, our associate producer. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, who's a vegetarian.
But I did make this one exception once. It was my friend's grandmother's homemade carne asada. I still dream about it. It was so good. Is that bad?
Elizabeth Fiedler.
Growing up, I liked Arby's roast beef sandwiches, steak tips from Western Sizzlin' dipped in A1 sauce.
Irina Zhorov, she was a vegetarian as a teenager.
And I almost caused an international diplomatic incident when I went to visit family in Uzbekistan and refused to eat their meat.
And Alan Yu, he grew up in Hong Kong and saw this.
I went to the market with my mother one time. There was a half-slaughtered cow lying in the middle of the street with its eyes open and blood oozing out.
When I was in seventh grade, my biology teacher had us dissect a chicken wing like you'd get at the supermarket.
That's Alex Stern. She helped produce this week's show.
I've been a vegetarian ever since.
Charlie Kyer is our engineer.
I worked on a pig farm in Italy, and the day after slaughter, we had some of the offcuts for lunch, and it was delicious.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Tanya English is our managing editor, and Hamburger Helper was a staple in her house growing up.
My mom would take a pound of ground beef out of the freezer in the morning, and by the time school was out, it would be brown and bloody, unthawed, sitting there waiting.
God, you guys are the worst. Nobody has any good food memories. Well, I'm Mike and Scott. I'm going to eat some chicken and pretend it's tofu, I guess. Thanks for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.